Life that shall endless be.
Our congratulations to Lewis and Doc Yingling. I don't know whether they're here tonight or not. Lewis, are you here? All right, congratulations, dears. We're proud for you. Although that's for somebody else. Must be for somebody else. Okay. The baby bed. All right, we'll get that for somebody else. When I was a freshman in college at Memphis State, my wife and I met during that year, and we began to date. We'd go to town fairly regularly in Memphis, and I noticed that she would always be walking about 10, 12, 15 paces behind me, looking in the store windows, you know, and I didn't think anything about it, and it came out years later that she was really ashamed to be walking with me, to be seen with me. And it was all because of an old coat I had. It was the only one I had. I thought it was a pretty hot number myself. It was a reversible job. But there was a big rip up the back of it. But I had pinned it meticulously to where the gap, you know, was no more, and it was pinned real nicely. But I found out some long time after it happened and after we were courting and after she kept dropping back behind me that that was the reason she was ashamed of me. Well, so were the elders of Union Avenue. I didn't realize it, but they were ashamed of it for the same reason. One day they called me, one of them did, asked me to come to town and eat dinner with him. Boy, and I thought, good, I thought I'd really arrived. I was going to town to eat dinner with one of the elders, and after dinner he took me into a clothier, bought me this beautiful overcoat. Man, I was so proud. I thought, these are the nicest folks I've ever seen. But really, way down deep, it was this thing. They were ashamed of me in that old coat. And they just didn't want me running around in it. So they bought me another one. The reason why I tell you that is because I want to talk to you tonight about being ashamed. In Romans, the first chapter in verse 16, Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God to salvation, to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is revealed the righteousness of God from faith to faith, as is written, the righteous by faith shall live. We look at this statement by Paul that he was not ashamed of the gospel. That may be something today that you have not accomplished yet. It's something today that does not really take on itself perhaps the same connotation that it did in the first century, because there were a lot of people back then that were ashamed of the message of Christ. There are a lot of people today that are ashamed of it also. But we at least admire this quality in Paul that says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And though the world was laughing up its sleeve, Paul stood there brave and bold and said, not I. I'm thankful and I'm proud to be a Christian. And I'm not ashamed of this message of Jesus Christ on a cross, resurrected, shed blood for the sins of humanity. Paul felt, like many of that day felt, that this is the real wisdom and power of God. Others felt like it was foolishness. Others felt that it was absolute sheer nonsense. To some, it was a stumbling block. But to those that were called, both Jews and Greeks, this was where it was at. It was in the gospel of Jesus Christ. But so often today, in the face of material possessions, in the face of materialism, in the face of peer pressure, in the face of the glory that the world can provide and the honors that come that are so shallow and yet that are so immediate and so enticing many times, so often we back down and in effect say, I'm ashamed really that I am a Christian. I know young men do it in your locker room. Sometimes the most vile language can be heard in the locker rooms of men who ought to be Christians. Among girls, it's heard also. They're getting to where many times they're as liberated and as filthy mouthed as men. It happens so many times in just various ways that we show that we're really ashamed to be called one who has been separated for Christ. It appears in the way we dress. You know, we dress to appear like the world. We don't want to look different from them. It's even now that there are Christian men wearing high heel shoes. I don't know whether you've got any on tonight. I don't really care. If you don't want to be known as a man, go on. Let yourself look like a woman. That's what it amounts to. But anyway, the way we dress, our shoes, our clothes, your hair. There are a lot of men that don't know really that a man's hair is to be shorter than a woman's hair. And you ought to be ashamed of it, but that's the way we succumb to the pressures. We want to be like other people around about us. And when the time really comes down to really standing up and saying, well, now, just a moment, I don't go for that, and I don't appreciate your putting that off on me. And I'm not going to buy your product, or I'm not going to go along with that style. And I'm not going to listen indiscriminately to that kind of music. And I'm not going to go and watch that kind of a movie. And I'm not going to read that kind of literature. And I'm not going to look like a woman. I'm going to look like a man. And I'm not going to, whatever it may be, that's the pressure. So many times, when peer pressure comes, we all just sometimes kind of knuckle down. I have. In my younger years, I did. And I'm sure that many of you have done the same thing. And I'm sorry for it. And I'm embarrassed now to think how that there were times when I said, in effect, well, I'm really ashamed to know Jesus Christ. And we do like Simon Peter did. Often, we do it in two different ways. Sometimes we just conform to the world. We just don't stand out. We more or less capitulate and start to imitate the world and look just like them and act just like them and do just like them because we're ashamed. Those who don't do that, we can also be ashamed of Christ and let it express itself in the way that we just congregate together and isolate ourselves from those who would oppose what we stand for. And we end up then just in an assembly like this talking to ourselves. And you see, I can say things like this to you perhaps that I couldn't say out somewhere else. And we take great pains to make sure that we get together where all of us here mostly say are Christians, and we can get together and talk about things like this where you might not find us, you see, down on the street corner. Or maybe over on the campus talking about things like this, because you might not be talking to a Christian over there or down on the street corner or in the marketplace. So few, many times, take the position that Paul took when he said, we destroy arguments and every proud obstacle to the knowledge of God and bring every thought into captivity to Jesus Christ. So many times we don't take that stand. Paul was an obnoxious nut, if you want to put it in the phrase, in the language that they would have used about him. Festus said to him one day when he was being tried, when Paul was being tried before Agrippa, and Paul came out with such fervor about his faith in Jesus Christ and that he'd been raised from the dead and that he was serving merely what his fathers and his grandfathers and all had looked forward to, the great patriarch. Festus said, Paul, you're mad. You've lost your mind. Your much learning is turning you mad. Paul said, I'm not mad, most excellent Festus, but I speak forth words of truth and soberness. And he was off again, talking about the same thing that he'd been talking about before. All he did had to slow down while Festus just said, you're mad. They couldn't get him to shut up. You see, he had been captured by this man, and he had staked his life on him in the face of death. He had placed his trust in Jesus of Nazareth, and he was there unreservedly, irretrievably committed to Jesus Christ. And I admire him for it, and I marvel at him. As he stood up in the face of all this opposition and just simply said, it didn't make any difference whether it was on a sinking ship or in a jail cell or in Caesar's palace or in some trial courtroom or wherever it may have been, in a synagogue, among his enemies, among his friends, among Gentiles, among Jews, in the city, in the wilderness, on the sea, in the cold, at night and day, just didn't make any difference. He was always standing up there talking about Jesus Christ. And that's why he could say, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Because it had actually captured him, heart, soul, mind, and body, to where he said, it's no longer I that's living. It's Christ living in me. But so many times we don't take that position, but we do admire it. We marvel at it, and we want to imitate it. But the thing that I marvel at more than that is the fact that, and this is what makes me then be caught in a bind to where I could never, ever anymore be ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It makes me so that we dare not ever be ashamed. How could we be? And it's this one simple fact that God is not ashamed of me. God is not ashamed of us. He said he's not. Now I realize that in his creation, when he created the heavens and the earth, and he made this great beautiful expanse of all the created things of the earth, the bodies of man and woman and their spirits and their mind and all being the crown of his creation. Whenever in Genesis 1:31 it records the fact that God had completed his creation, he looked at it and said, it's very good. And you know it is. When you think about the greatness of the creation of God, it makes you just stand back and say, What more could you have done that you haven't already done? The grandeur and all, and the great infinite care and all that he's used in creating it, it is very good. And he wasn't ashamed to say, that's my work. I did that. And you're the work of my hands. You're the sheep of my pasture. I am your God. I'm the one that created all of these things. And he's all the way through the Old Testament pictured himself as being proud of his creation. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about not him being proud of the pre-fall creation. I'm talking about him being proud of people who have come since the fall and who have been a part of the fall. He even says, I'm proud to be called even your God. I'm glad to be called that you're my people. For example, in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and about verse 16, where it says there, yes, he speaks of these people, Abraham and Noah and Abel and all these people, David and the rest of these great heroes of faith. It says that they've desired a better country. And he says he's not ashamed to be called their God, for he's prepared for them a city. And that just simply says that he's committed himself to them. Now, I realize that these were the great heroes of faith. But will you remember, please, that though they were heroes of faith, they were people like Abraham who had lied on two occasions. They were people like David who committed adultery and murder. They were people like Samson. Now, God's not proud of those things. But nevertheless, he has, in a sense, in a very real sense, committed himself to those people who committed themselves to him and says, I'm not ashamed to be called their God. In the book of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, these three prophets all spoke of this prevailing attitude that God has toward his creation. Fallen humanity, imperfect, and yet people whom he has found himself willing to say, these are my people, and I'm proud to be called their God. And Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel, all three mention this fact, and these three prophets are summed up in 2 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, where he makes this statement about these particular people, and we're part of this. I will live in them and move among them. I will be their God, and they'll be my people. Therefore, come out from them and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch nothing unclean. Then I'll receive you or welcome you, and I'll be a father to you, and you shall be to me sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. You see that promise? He's simply saying that I've committed myself to you. Ephesians, the 2nd chapter, tells us what the fulfillment of that prophecy is. The fulfillment of this prophecy from Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel is the church of the living God, you and me. And in Ephesians 2, he says, therefore, you're no more strangers and sojourners, but you're fellow citizens with the saints of the household of God. Jesus Christ, or being built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself, the chief cornerstone. Then he says, in which you have been made, let me read it, it's a bit difficult to quote, in whom the whole structure is joined together and grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are built into it for a holy or a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. You see, this whole thing of the church, he says, has been made so that God could actually dwell in us and recognize us as his people, and then he be recognized as our God and as the one who occupies us. He's not ashamed of us. So in a sense, you see, he's saying here, you people, every one of you, you, those of you who've committed yourself to Jesus Christ, he's saying to you, you're my kind of people. You're my people, and I'm glad to be called your God. I'm not ashamed of you. But who is it that he's talking about? Well, Jesus Christ elaborates on it, and in his life we can see who it is that he's talking about when he says, I'm not ashamed of you. For example, in Hebrews, the 2nd chapter in verse 11, the writer there quotes a prophecy. Well, he doesn't quote the prophecy first. He makes this statement, for he who sanctifies, that is Jesus Christ, and those who are sanctified, that is the church, have all one origin. That's why he's not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will proclaim thy name to my brethren in the midst of the congregation. I will praise thee. And again, I'll put my trust in him. And again, here I am and the children whom God has given me. Jesus Christ shows himself here, and this passage of Scripture shows himself as being one, and we've studied it in detail, so much so that you might say, well, let's go on to something else, and we will, but I want to bring it up to you one more time. This passage calls to our mind that Jesus Christ was a man who was not ashamed to be associating with folks like you and me. He wasn't ashamed. In fact, it says it here. He was not ashamed to call them his brethren. He says we have the same origin. He who sanctifies and those who are sanctified have the same origin, so he's not ashamed to call them his brethren. He's not ashamed to associate with the likes of you and me. And that says a lot. He talks about his willingness to associate with the people who were sinners. And in the book of Mark, and in, well, throughout the gospel, but it's in Mark 2:15 where it says that the Pharisees and Sadducees looked down upon him and criticized him because he was associating and eating with sinners. And Jesus turned and said to them, "Why, the whole have no need of a physician. It's the sick that need the physician." He said, "I have come to call not the righteous but the sinners to repentance." And he shows right then that he identified himself with those who were the outcasts and said, "I'm not ashamed to be known as being a friend of these people." In fact, he came to be known as a friend of publicans and sinners. A friend of publicans and sinners. In the book of Luke, chapter 19 and verse 41, Jesus so identified himself with the city of Jerusalem that he wept over it. Cried as he stood there and wept over it and said, "Oh, if you'd only known, even today, the things that make for peace, but now they're hid from your eyes. They're hid and it's too late." But it wouldn't be if even today you would just knew, if you just knew what belonged to peace. But he wept over the city. On another occasion he wept and said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how oft would I have gathered thy children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you wouldn't." But it showed that he identified himself with these Jewish people. And yet the very people over whom he wept were the people who eventually despised him and turned their back upon him. The obstinate, the unthankful, the people who were disobedient to God. He was weeping over these people. But he wasn't ashamed of the people to whom he came. He wanted to be among them and wanted to show himself as being one who offered himself as the way if they would only accept it. He was not ashamed to die the death that he died in order that these people might have real life. In the book of Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2, it says that we need to follow this one, that Jesus Christ is our author and the finisher of our faith, and that he, because of the joy set before him, endured the cross and despised the shame. Now, this shame that he's talking about here was the shameful death that he died as a common thief or as a common criminal. And yet it says that he just simply discounted it, didn't even consider it, because of the joy that was set before him of accumulating all these followers who would come out of the world and who would come and establish their lives on him. That joy overshadowed the shame of the death that he had to die. We also find in Luke that he wasn't ashamed of the people for whom he died. You know the thief on the cross. I've mentioned him so many times. "Oh, love that will not let me go." The hook in the gospel of Jesus Christ that won't let me go is this man, the thief, and the treatment that he received by Jesus Christ. And Jesus saved the man who couldn't offer him anything, who couldn't profit him anything, whose the movement of Jesus Christ was not enhanced one whit by the coming along of this thief and joining the ranks of the sanctified. No, sir. Jesus wasn't benefited by this man's joining him. If anything, he was a detriment. He was a hindrance. If anything, he would have been something on the other side of the ledger that would be a disaster for any movement. And yet Jesus said, "Come on, I want you with me today. You're going to be with me in paradise." To me, that's the most beautiful statement in all the Bible. You know what it says? There's a message there for us. The message is simply this: you don't get too worthless for Jesus Christ to say, "I want to be with you. I'm not ashamed to call you my brethren." And if that's not what that thief on the cross, if that's not what it says, I don't know what it says. And you don't find Jesus hanging back looking in the windows, you know, as though he were window shopping, while we go along with our torn coat and the thief there with all of his filthiness and all everything else. You don't find him hanging back and looking in the windows, you know, playing like he doesn't really know who we are, or doesn't know that, don't want anybody else to know who we are or that we're with him. When we come with him to his Father, he doesn't bring us there and kind of just say, "Well, this isn't too good. Lord, this wasn't a very good catch. Sorry about it. There just wasn't much of going today for these folks, and this is the best I could do." That's not the way he acts. Listen to what it said. We get the picture of what he's talking about when it says in the book of Hebrews, in quotes out of Isaiah, "Here I am, Lord, and the children that you've given me." As though he was saying, "Man, I'm proud of these folks. Look at them. Here we are, God. Here we are, Father. Here I am and all these children that you've given me. Look at them. Here they are." As though his buttons were just bursting. And yet when you look back in there, you see a thief and you see Mary Magdalene and you see Simon Peter and you see all these other people that really are a worthless lot. And yet here Jesus Christ stands and says, "Here we are, Lord, I and all these children that you've given me." He's not ashamed. You see, that's what it means. He's not ashamed to call us his brethren. But that's one thing that this Hebrews 2:11 mentions. There's another thing. It identifies the cause. wherefore or whereby he's not ashamed to call us his brethren. And that cause is simply this. It says this, he that sanctifies and those that are sanctified are of the same origin. That is why he is not ashamed to call them his brethren. And there he pinpoints the key to this thing. It's those people who have committed themselves unreservedly to Jesus Christ. That commitment to Jesus Christ is the reason why he's not ashamed to call them brethren. These people have been sanctified. Now, they may not be worth anything. They may not, in the very present tense, be worth the time it would take to go get them. And yet, the very fact that they have committed themselves to Jesus Christ makes them a class of people that Jesus says, they are my people, and I'll not be ashamed of them. They and I, we're of the same origin. We're brothers. But it requires this separation. And brethren, you'll never make it unless you're willing to commit yourself to Jesus Christ on his terms. This is what he means also in Mark, the 3rd chapter, verses 31 and 32. When on one occasion down in Caesarea, there were so many people gathered around him that his mother and his brothers and all couldn't get to him. And someone sent a message to him and said, Jesus, your mother and your brothers and sisters, they're out there wanting to talk to you. And Jesus just asked the question, who is my mother? Who are my brothers and sisters? And then look what he did. And I don't guess there were any fewer people maybe than are here tonight. He looked around at all that motley crew that were gathered around him, and he just pointed to them and said, these are my brothers and sisters. For whoever does the will of my Father, the same is my mother and my brothers and my sisters. In other words, he's saying, I'm not ashamed. If you're willing to do the will of my Father, that makes you my people. And I've committed myself to you just like you've committed yourself to me. And in 2 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, in verse 17, that amalgamation of the prophecies of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, those three prophecies that say, I'll be their God, and they're going to be my people, it was predicated upon one commitment, and that was this. Come ye out from among them, and be ye separate, says the Lord, and touch no unclean thing. Then I'll receive you. Then I'll be your God. Then you'll be my sons and daughters. But it was predicated upon this decision of these people to commit themselves to Jesus Christ, to commit themselves to God, to the extent that they would come out of the world and stop this infernal acting like the world. He says, come out from among them, and don't you touch any unclean thing. And then I'll receive you, and then you'll be my sons and my daughters, and I'll be your God. But it's predicated, this thing of his accepting us and not being ashamed of us, is predicated upon the fact that we have taken our stand upon Jesus Christ, and we say, come what may, good or bad, lose or gain, we're committed to Jesus Christ, and we're going to do what he says regardless. That kind of person, Jesus says, you're my kind of people. And so we see that that's what he's talking about here. And in Matthew, the 10th chapter, in verse 32 and 33, he makes the same statement. Whoever confesses me before men, I'll confess him before my Father in heaven. But he that denies me before men, I'm going to deny him before my Father in heaven. Therefore, we see that what he's talking about when he says he's not ashamed of us is this. Jesus Christ and God are not ashamed of those people who have committed themselves to God and who've said, I'm going to stand upon Jesus Christ. I'm going to commit my life to him. Come what may, I'm his. That's the kind of people that he says, I'm not ashamed to be called their God. He's not ashamed of us. Now watch. That kind of person, God has given us an assurance, and this is it. He has decreed that all people who thus commit themselves to him shall never have any cause to be ashamed of anything that they do. And that's one of the most beautiful promises in all the Bible. It just simply says that there will never be an occasion where anyone who ever puts his trust in Jesus Christ and builds his life upon Jesus Christ, there never will be an occasion to be ashamed before anybody. You won't ever have any cause to be ashamed. You know, the people of the world are one day going to be so ashamed of the things they've done. There's going to come a reckoning, people. There's going to come a reckoning for this generation. And I don't want to ride any hobby, but let me tell you something. Any parent who allows his sons and his daughters to so mix up their sexual identity that they cannot tell whether they're male or female, you're going to reap a sad harvest one day. You're going to reap it. You're going to be so embarrassed when your sons turn up to be homosexuals and your daughters lesbians. You're going to wonder, oh, cry for the rocks and the mountains to fall upon us, because nothing less than that will hide you from the shame that's going to come upon you. And those of you young men and women who do not have enough identity about yourself and enough certainty about yourself to know whether you're a male or a female, and who are willing to become the dupes of a generation of people who are completely and totally depraved, to where you, as sons of the living God, who ought to be dressing like sons and daughters of the King, find yourself dressing like sons and daughters of the King of this world, Satan, you're going to be awfully ashamed one day. I saw a young man out at an eating establishment here several weeks ago, and I couldn't tell whether he was a girl or a boy. Finally, I did discern that he was a boy. There sat his mother and father, and I thought, you poor soul, I'm sorry that you're like that, and I wish that you had a mother and father who would make you see that you need to know who you are. But there's so many other things that make a person ashamed. Those people who've committed themselves and trusted themselves to things, you're going to be so ashamed when you see all these things that you've accumulated, all of them just going up in smoke. You're going to be so ashamed that you've invested all of your life in these things. And when the thieves break through and steal, and the moths corrupt, and the rust rusts and corrupts, you're going to be ashamed that you didn't put yourself and your life's investment in something that was more permanent and something that was eternal. You're going to be ashamed to see that all that you've done in life just go up in smoke because you put your trust in things. This catering to the world and bowing and kowtowing and scraping to the world in all of its designs and everything else that the world does. You're going to be ashamed when you see the outcome. In the book of Romans, the writer of Romans, Paul, makes the statement in the 6th chapter, "Tell me," he said, "what return did you get from those things of which you are now ashamed?" Oh, he refers them back to that time before they became Christians. And he says, "I want you to look at your ledger and tell me what kind of return did you get from those things of which you are now ashamed? What did you get from it? Any return?" And he said, "The wages or the return that you get from those things is just death." In Ephesians, the 5th chapter, Paul says this, "Have nothing to do with these unfruitful works of darkness, but rather rebuke them, because it is actually a shame to speak of the things that they do in private or in secret." And in the book of Revelation, it speaks of these people who are so ashamed, who will cry for the rocks and the mountains to fall upon them and hide them from the face of God and from the wrath of the Lamb, because they say their day of wrath has come, and who's able to stand? I'll guarantee you that one of the things that's going to make them call for the rocks and the mountains to fall upon them is the fact that they will be totally and absolutely ashamed of the fact that they have failed in the one commitment that had been given to them, their life. They've failed. They've made a complete mess of it. And they don't have what it takes to stand up and face the God who was the giver of this great blessing of life. But the Christian's not ashamed. He has no reason to be. Never will be. The person that trusts in Jesus Christ never will be or never will have any cause to be ashamed. Back in Isaiah, it's mentioned in the 28th chapter. And it's again mentioned in Romans, the 9th chapter in verse 33. And in the 10th chapter in verse 11, there's this promise. Back in Isaiah, it was this. "Whoever believes or trusts in the Lord shall never be in haste." Now that's the statement in Isaiah. He won't be in haste. He won't be in a hurry. You know what that means? In the New Testament translation of that, the prophecy there was quoted as being, "He'll never be ashamed." And it's very interesting to see how that this word "being in a hurry" is the same thing as being ashamed. Well, yeah. Have you ever been in a hurry to get out of a place where you were just totally embarrassed over something? And you just make every effort, you know, just to kind of scoot out or go through a hole or do whatever to get out of the way or get into a crack, you know? That's what Isaiah was talking about. Whoever trusts in God will never have any cause to have to wish that he could go into a hole and pull it in after him. That's what he's saying. And Paul quotes him and says he'll never be ashamed. His very life right now, there's no cause for the Christian to be ashamed. He'll never be an unwed mother. She'll never be an unwed mother. He'll never be an unwed father. There won't be any shame attached to that because they're living their life for Jesus Christ. They won't have to stand before their parents in all this shame and all this embarrassment and say, "We've messed up our lives." Christians guarded against that. Jesus Christ said, "The man that hears my teachings and does them," I'll tell you what he's like. He's like a man that built his house on a rock. And when all these pressures of life began to come, and when the things of life then in your life that should have been not put there by Christ, whenever these things in the lives of the world began to disintegrate and the house began to cave in, the Christian can stand on solid ground and say, "That's not my case. I've put my trust in Jesus Christ." No cause for being ashamed. In the book of Galatians, the writer there makes the statement, "The fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and long-suffering and goodness and faithfulness and brotherly kindness." These things, he said, there's no law against them. Against such there is no law. And there never has been a law where a person would ever stand up and in the face of the Christian shake his finger and say, "Shame, shame on you. You were loving and kind and faithful and generous and all these things, and you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Never. And you can never expect to see a day when a person would be ashamed for having lived that kind of a life. There is no law, written or unwritten, heathen or otherwise, that ever made a person who did these things feel ashamed. Never. Well, he that trusts on the Lord shall never be ashamed. In 1 Peter, Peter mentions this and says, let none of you suffer as a murderer or as a thief or as a meddler in other men's affairs. But if any man suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this name, which is so much as to say there's no reason, there's no cause. The Christian will never have any reason to be ashamed. So I find this very beautiful thought that not only is God not ashamed of us who have committed ourselves to him, but then he's given you this guarantee. He's given you a scotch. He's put you something, you know, where you can't fail. He's just simply said, all right, those of you who are not ashamed to commit yourself to me, I'll make it so that you'll never, ever be ashamed of me. And in that great resurrection morning, when the sons of the living God who have come forth upon the foundation of Jesus Christ, when they finally stand up on the resurrection morning, Jesus Christ said, then shall the sons of the kingdom shine forth as bright as the sun. You know what I think he's talking about? I think he's talking at least partly about the countenance of these people, their very expression on their faces. Here they have gone through life committing themselves to Jesus Christ in faith. And then all of a sudden, wham, here comes the resurrection morning. The dead are raised up, all this tremendous upheaval of history, the termination of all of time, and Jesus Christ comes down and scoops up those people who are going to be his. Then shall the sons of the kingdom absolutely burst forth in joy, and their countenance will actually shine like the sun because their hope has now become a reality, and they'll not be ashamed. They're not going to be like these people that just simply cower and cower down and call for the rocks and the mountains to fall upon them. Look at this contrast. There'll be some that call for the rocks and the mountains to fall on them. Others are going to be just shining forth as bright as the sun. It's because of the fact that those who put their trust in Jesus Christ never will be put to shame. 2,000 years of cross-examination of Jesus Christ have never yet proved him wrong in one single point. Not one. And I don't care what science you may subject him to, whether it be psychology or sociology or whatever else it may be, that relates to people living with people and living for people and living with God and living honestly. Jesus Christ comes out second best to nobody. He's always been proved right. And you can just simply put your foot on him. You can build your life on him. And you can stand there just as firm, and you can tell your children. And I thank God for one thing, and it's this. In Jesus Christ, he's given me the way to raise my children. Thank God for him. So that I don't have to wonder if it's the right instruction. I don't have to wonder if it's the right advice. I know when I can tell them, now, son or daughter, this is what Jesus Christ wants you to do. Man, I can tell them that and go to sleep and sleep all night long, because I know I'll never have to back up and retract my statement. I know I'll never have to say, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong in that. Jesus was wrong. Not so. You'll never have to do it. No one who ever trusts in God, who commits himself to God, will ever be put to shame. So actually, to talk about this thing of being ashamed of Christ is embarrassing when I realize the fact that he has said, I'm not ashamed of you. And the fact that he said, I'll never let you ever be ashamed. You're going to come out on top. How on earth could we ever be ashamed of him? And this song states it. We sang a moment ago. Jesus Christ, and shall it be Jesus Christ, and shall it ever be a mortal man ashamed of thee? Ashamed of thee whom angels praise, whose glory shines through endless days. Ashamed of Jesus, soon or far let evening blush to own a star. He sheds the beams of light divine o'er this benighted soul of mine. Ashamed of Jesus, that dear friend on whom my hopes of heaven depend. No, when I blush, be this my shame, that I no more revere his name. Ashamed of Jesus, yes, I may, when I've no guilt to wash away, no tear to wipe, no good to crave, no fears to quell, no soul to save. Till then, nor is my boasting vain, till then I'll boast a Savior slain. And oh, may this my glory be, that Christ is not ashamed of me. Brethren, stand up for Jesus. And let's stop this imitating the world, and let's come to the place where we say, I'm committed to him. Life or death, regardless of what, I'm committed to Jesus Christ. And if you want to commit yourself to him on that way, in that way, and come and say, this is it. I'm making it known that I'm standing up for the Lord. And when the Lord goes one way and the world goes another, I'm going to go with the Lord. I don't care what they say about me. Let me read you this warning just in closing. Jesus called his disciples to him, and he said to them, if any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does a man profit if he gains the whole world and loses his life? For what can a man give in return for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in glory of his Father with his holy angels. He wants you to commit yourself to him. And for those who will, without reservation, he says to you, I'm not ashamed to be called your brother. I want you with me. Oh, that's a great promise. Would you like to do that? Come tonight. If you will, commit your life to him. If you want to commit your life initially, be born into him. Be born of the water and the Spirit. The water is prepared. Everything is ready. If your heart has been developed in faith to where it expresses itself now in this action of repentance and baptism, would you come and confess him tonight? And if you're already a Christian and just need to take your stand and let it be known whose side you're on, so that Christ, when the time comes that the real divider is made, that he'll make it known which side you're on then. If you need to make that statement, come while we stand and sing.